Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We missed you on Friday. I was out ill. Jim was out of town on the business, but we're glad to have you back today. And we've got good, bad, and crazy martinis, as always. The good martini is, Jim, I think Republicans, for the most part, conservatives especially here, pretty much won as much of as they could have won on this air traffic controller thing. We were hoping at the beginning of last week that it would just be more of a big scare tactic, chicken little type thing. It turned out that they actually did a pretty good job of throwing a lot of people's schedules off. But Republicans in Congress made sure that Harry Reid didn't get what he wanted in suspending the sequester for the year. Instead, they found, surprise, surprise, some unused taxpayer dollars in the FAA budget to cover the supposed cost necessary to bring all these furloughed air traffic controllers back. So it was ugly. A lot of people's weeks were messed up as a result. But in the end, Democrats definitely didn't get what they wanted here.
Yeah, and it's worth noting, I mean, if you want to implement some sort of change in government policy, and you want to have it affect a lot of people, and you want to have it affect the kind of people who are likely to complain loudly, likely to complain publicly, and likely to complain to their congressman, lousing up the air traffic schedule is probably a good way to do it. These are people who generally are slightly wealthier than your average American and more likely to have, you know, business issues and be very, you know, there are no such thing as quiet dissatisfied air travelers anymore. So you have a circumstance, and we're going to have a template for how any following sequester fights are going to occur. If any other part of the government says, well, because of these sequester cuts, we have to cut this utterly vital public service. What you're going to see is the same thing you saw here and the same thing you saw with the White House tours and all of the other hard sob stories we've heard in the last couple of weeks, which is that look at how the government agency is spending its money. Look at how the budget has grown year by year, and then say, wait a second, how can this, you know, 4% cut cause 10% of your flights to be, of your air traffic controller folks to be shut down? Apparently, what they were announcing under this was worse than the absolute worst day of delays of the entire last year. You know, all over a 4% budget cut, which is, you know, pretty small potatoes in the grand scheme of things. So good to see this. I will also note, however, now I was traveling last week. Some folks might be asking, did you have any sequester-related delays or problems at the airport? And the good news, Greg, is that I did not. The bad news is that you do not want to fly out of Orlando on a Saturday morning because everyone who has just spent a week at Disney World or Universal Studios or any of that other stuff, you know, they spend their week, they go back on Saturday. It's all families on the incredibly long security line, the sign that says the wait is 15 minutes from here, my fanny, it's 15 minutes. Needless to say, lots of strollers and, you know, child carriers and a million bags and all kinds of stuff like that. The other thing is TSA gets a lot of very deserved grief. However, if they started to taser people who brought suitcases on board insisting that they're carry-ons, I would be willing to give them greater authority and discretion in that, because now it seems like there are folks who basically, if I put a handle on a refrigerator box, then technically it's a carry-on. And I'm sorry, it's just not going to fit in the overhead bin, sir. So those are my little helpful hints for making air travel easier, having meandered a far distance away from the original point of this good martini.
So no groping, but more tasering in the right circumstances.
I
think that's a compromise a lot of people could get behind. And I appreciated the local color there in Orlando. We should make sure that you know, though, that Pat Toomey was back in the good martini for his comments last week, saying that even with the sequestration, the FAA had more money to spend than what President Obama requested. So that was an excellent point that the Republicans made repeatedly throughout the week. On to martini number two now, and a decidedly less pleasant martini, as it always is. But this one, especially so, it was last week that the always eloquent Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, along with ultimately the White House itself, confirming that its intelligence shows that at least on an occasion back in March and perhaps in other limited uses, the Syrian government has used weapons of mass destruction, specifically chemical weapons, and specifically, it would appear, sarin gas against its enemies. The casualty numbers aren't necessarily what a lot of people might expect because it apparently has been limited use. But now the question becomes, Jim, what do we do about it? Because the use of weapons of mass destruction was the quote-unquote red line that the president drew in the sand. A lot of people were excited about that, especially the likes of John McCain, who thinks we should have already been there. Other people not very excited because they see this as essentially two sides that we can't stand, and why not let them duke it out instead of them focusing on us? But if you're going to have a red line and then you ignore it, as the president now seems to be waffling on in terms of, well, we need to really define exactly what happened and make sure that this intel is right, what other red lines are people going to believe, particularly someone like the Iranians, who have perhaps far more sinister intentions with their weapons of mass destruction?
You know, Greg, I have a sinister neocon membership card. It's a little frayed and tattered. I don't know if I've updated it since 2007 or so. But I am one of those folks who, you know, back when we were considering intervention in Libya, would believe that, you know, preventing massacres is a perfectly legitimate use of the U.S. military. And while I understand people's natural reticence about open-ended humanitarian missions, I think that if you have somebody who's going to use poison gas to slay or hurt a great number of people, you know, that's a thing that's worth, you know, the, having the U.S. military intervene to prevent or to mitigate. Now, as we said, as you pointed out, there's kind of a vageness about just how, whether it really was sarin and just how broadly it was used, but I don't think Obama was out of line for putting that red line there. I think we are really in trouble if our conclusion is, well, really doing anything is going to be very complicated. So if you cross the red line, we're going to go back to the UN and get even more sanctions to a war-torn country that is to basically a riot with a zip code these days. Syria, there are not a lot of really good, easy options. And I realize that, you know, a country that's been through Afghanistan and Iraq is going to be very, very hesitant. However, if we say there will be serious consequences for crossing the red line, the Syrian regime crosses the red line, and then nothing happens, believe me, that message is going to be heard in Tehran, and we're going to see a whole lot of dominoes falling as a result of this. So when we say U.S. credibility is on the line, it's not some airy theoretical concept we're talking about. We're basically, the world may be getting the signal the United States isn't really willing to intervene under any circumstances. And if that's the case, then it's the Wild West out there. Anybody can do whatever they want, knowing that the UN is never really going to intervene with them. I'm strongly thinking of the memorable scene from Team America World Police, where Hans Brix goes to tell Kim Jong-il to stop funding terrorism. It does not turn out well for Hans Brix in that lovely puppet movie. So.
I'm guessing the red line did not refer to a strongly worded statement at the UN, perhaps, but given this administration, that's probably what he did mean. So we'll find out exactly what other evidence comes up here. But, you know, the Israelis have come to that conclusion, and some of the Western European allies as well. So the president's got some interesting decisions to make here. On to the crazy martini now. And, you know, it's an odd numbered year, so we don't have a ton of elections that are happening this year to pay close attention to. We've got the South Carolina special congressional race coming up next week, and we've got two major governor's races. New Jersey's looking, at this point, like a runaway. But in Virginia, of course, we pretty much have the decks cleared for Ken Cuccinelli against Terry McAuliffe, and the gloves have been thrown off, and the swinging has been pretty frequent ever since that fact has been known. And the big issue for Terry McAuliffe, as we've discussed in this podcast, is all the headaches involving green tech. First of all, we talked a lot about the visa issue, which a lot of unanswered questions remain there. Then, of course, there's the major question. If you claim to be a great job creator in Virginia, why didn't you create your company in Virginia instead of Mississippi? And that question came up once again as Terry McAuliffe was a guest of Jan Painter on Virginia Public Television. And here's McAuliffe's eloquent response to her question on that front.
Talk some more about how you would attract businesses to the state. Mm-hmm. And also, why did you locate green tech out of state?
Well, our corporate headquarters. We tried. It didn't work out. It is what it is.
Well, there you go. I'm sure that'll fit pretty well into a 30-second ad, Jim.
My brother used to joke that whenever he got tired of hearing the term, it is what it is, from a losing coach, an athlete who has lost a game. Usually it's one of you when you've just had a great disappointment and your team has lost or you have not performed the way you wanted to, by golly, you end up having to say something to the press, and it's very, very tough to say anything other than we didn't do what we wanted to do. So, you know, you send up saying these nothing statements like it is what it is. And I think my brother suggested something like bottle, wire, pencil, or some sort of random sequence of words, because he said that makes about as much sense as it is what it is. It is an absolute mashed potato statement. In the case of Terry McAuliffe, I'm glad they're asking on this. You know, it's interesting that he didn't try the usual excuse of, well, we wanted to set up our plant here, but the state wouldn't play ball with us, since PolitiFact had basically dismantled that argument by looking at all the memos and interplay between the company and the government agency in charge of attracting business to the Commonwealth of Virginia. If you're Terry McAuliffe, your main tie to politics is that you've been a very successful fundraiser for Bill Clinton and for Hillary Clinton, and not much governing experience. You ran for governor 4 years ago and got like 20-some percent of the vote. Even most Democrats didn't really understand why this guy was qualified or why he'd be a good choice to be the governor of the state. Fast forward 4 years, he's thrown around a lot of money around the state. You could argue he's bought the nomination. There are still some Democrats who can't quite believe that McAuliffe is going to be their nominee. And so now the question is, Mr. McAuliffe, why should you be governor? What have you done other than spend a lot of money in this state? And the argument was traditionally, well, I know business. I know how to create jobs. And you look at green tech, and I think that's very much in dispute right now. One is that he didn't set up the company in Virginia. He set it up in Mississippi. But I think even more than that, you look at what they've done in Mississippi, and I believe they're employing something in the neighborhood of like 180 people right now. Now, he had promised this plant was going to create thousands and thousands of jobs. The other thing, which is you look at the business history of Terry McAuliffe, and he's been fairly open about this in past, you know, New York Times interviews and such. He's always done business with the people he's connected to in politics. And that strikes me as just about the definition of crony capitalism. And that, you know, strikes me as a exactly what I don't want to see in Richmond. Somebody put it well that everything Democrats said about Mitt Romney that wasn't true is true in the case of Terry McAuliffe. And it's going to be kind of fascinating to see this absolute total role reversal. One of the things we've probably talked about in the past three Martini lunches, and I know I've talked about on Campaign Spot, Republicans are now screaming at the top of their lungs that Terry McAuliffe has to release his tax returns for the past 8 years, as Ken Cuccinelli did. I have no idea what they think they're going to find in there. I will note that they're acting like they're going to find some glaring race-defining scandal beyond he's wealthy. Either they know something really sinister is in there, or they're playing a very cynical game. But either way, it does say something interesting that Terry McAuliffe will not release his tax returns and has instead released summaries of his tax activity to certain favored reporters. So I guess the voters of Virginia may conclude whether they think there's something that's being hidden there.
Long way to go still in this race, but it's already been really fun. So hopefully it stays that way. Jim, talk to you tomorrow.
Looking forward to Greg. See you tomorrow.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.